this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
Okay, so Foe, we start in a letter form, and Susan Barton has been cast away from a ship and lands on a small, shitty island with two men, Friday and Crusoe. She has time there with them. She gets to see their simple lifestyle. She has a little a sexual moment with Crusoe, and then they're saved like a year later, except for Crusoe dies and Friday is taken away off the island, and he's been there for 30 years. So she ends up carrying these people back with her to England and looking for someone to tell the story, and that's where Daniel Defoe comes in. Foe, the titular Foe who wrote Robinson Crusoe. She's looking for an author. And so we've got this interesting side story. Like, that's what this whole hinges on. It's this alternate reality where did the story Robinson Crusoe came from? Well, it actually came from a woman who landed on the island and got to understand the man and then came to tell his story and is looking for the story. It's kind of hard to tell because it gets the time is all mixed up. So she's writing these letters, but he might not have read any of these letters just yet. And before, Susan Barton was looking for her daughter. And that's a story that we don't go into. We just see her being a castaway in the waves. She woke up in the water, I think is paraphrasing the beginning. And so she sees a little girl that doesn't look anything like her daughter, but claims to be her daughter, but also has her same name, Susan Barton. So it's like a poor joke or a weird setup, and that it doesn't make sense. And she's trying to find Foe, but he's running away from debtors. And she understands that he writes stories and has read some of them and takes up living in his house because he can't be there, and takes in this, Friday. She keeps Friday, doesn't know what to do with him. And we can go into all the relationships in a little bit. But basically, she finds Foe and is able to impress upon him her story. And they have an argument themselves. And this is another part of the big part of this relationship. Because he wants to tell one story and she wants to tell another. And we have the matter of fact in the reader's world of the novel by Daniel Defoe, Robinson Crusoe. And we have her story and we know that Susan Barton is nowhere in the other story. So in pairing out the relationship, you're wondering, why did Susan Barton get left out? And we can talk more about that. I have some ideas, but so we have this whole side story where a woman was cast away and came back and told the story and is living the story you never heard of Robinson Crusoe and how the story came to be. That's really rudimentary, and I think it misses a lot. But is there any other things that stand out? Like the girl doesn't really get resolved. That's kind of like a mysterious part of chapter 4, I think.
So much doesn't get worked out within the book. And I think that I think you did a perfectly fine job of summarizing it because it's a difficult, I think it's a very, very difficult book to summarize.
It is. Very difficult.
Have any of us actually read the original Robinson Crusoe?
I read it when I was a little kid, like a little kid. And I remember just being confused by the language, but I remember almost none of it. And have just gone back and read sections of it while I was reading this.
And, yeah, I looked into it myself.
Yeah, and if you watch Buñuel's movie, the movie that Buñuel made is kind of fascinating.
I'd read it several times. I had read it several times as a kid, and I remember it being really short. And when I looked up the version of the novel, it's 450 pages. So I had clearly read like a picture, heavily abridged version of it.
For kids.
Right.
Yeah.
That's funny. It was a constant question in my mind how much my lack of knowledge about Robinson Crusoe, the novel, was impeding my understanding of this book, what I wasn't picking up on because of not read it, having read that one.
Yeah, there are only some points where I was wondering if my lack of knowledge was not making me understand what was said. I think during Crusoe's death scene, one of the question marks I had, I think he had some sort of line as far as like Mahala or Maha, and I wasn't sure if that was some sort of point towards something that had happened in the novel. I wasn't even actually sure if Friday was mute in the novel, to be honest. I didn't check that much out.
Yeah, I hadn't read the novel either. I mean, I remember having read it, but I was just young. It's like, I know that I read, I remember the covers of the books, you know, this was A Wrinkle in Time. I know that I've read it, but I couldn't tell you anything about it, you know. And so, yeah, likewise, I wasn't sure about the details. But whenever I was reading this, it didn't bother me. I just let that amplify anything that I chose, you know, could choose, because I realized that it would have a larger backstory, or that it's playing in that world. So, you know, Friday just got to be more mythical because I knew that I could go and read 1,000 words on him or something, or 1,000 pages rather, because it's a really long book though, isn't it? Rather than being short. I remember a big hardback version.
Robinson Crusoe?
Yeah.
Anyway, you talking about the book?
Like, yeah. I said, the PDF I downloaded was like close to 500 pages.
Yeah, it's long.
So. Yeah. So I knew that there was so much more that was being like, and it's almost just kind of like to play with the language of the story and what it's about. Like, that's the silence of having that bigger story looming as you read this one. Because, I mean, of course, you can't help but know that and know that coming into it. So what that brings, and I'm sure that it would be a much richer experience if you could have read the whole thing.
I think a really important part of this is really, what does the Robinson Crusoe story have to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't believe Friday in the original is mute. And I think that was a strategy. That's it. You know, this whole book is focused on the power of language. And so, I mean, again, I think we need to look at the fact that, okay, so whether you did read Crusoe as a kid or you never read Crusoe or whatever, what does it matter really? Because I don't think it has as much to do with this story.
I think it's actually a pretty simple answer. I mean, like, first, well, just to go back a little bit, I do think that he was mute. But just because I've seen the trope of a mute Man Friday and other things, and it makes me
think he was mute in the original?
I do.
I don't remember him being mute. I mean, I know that they had trouble communicating, but I don't remember that.
Well, then maybe Crusoe cut out his tongue, and that's something that we, you know, would be the answer to that. Then if maybe there's a story where he was speaking, and
I'm gonna Google that. Did Crusoe chop out Friday's tongue?
That's a question that Susan Barton wonders. She doesn't know.
Yeah, she doesn't know.
And so I think that, like, you asked maybe a rhetorical question, but I think the simple thing of why we don't see Susan Barton in the novel, and like why there's a story about this, is like what she was trying to impart on him at the end in her conversation with him. He was asking about Bahia, you know, you had a daughter, what did you do for work? Did you like have these fantasies that you'd be reunited with her and all that stuff? And she's like, that's my personal story, and that's not what I'm interested in making public. What I am interested in making public and having help actually excavating with the author is this part of my life, which I can't even reckon with. I realized that I got a glimpse of a deep mystery because there's 30 years of history there and unsaid things that can't be spoken of. And I only got to glimpse it for a year, and I'm carrying this with me now. Like, I want someone to help me with this. And that's the story. And so I think that she has impressed on him the importance of being stranded on an island. But I think that maybe it's a criticism of Foe, because if you take the novel Robinson Crusoe to be the answer after this story, right? Like, let's just switch up the chronology here. Then he left Susan Barton out entirely. And so maybe she would have wanted that, but I suspect that she would have wanted a little bit of the notoriety, a little bit of, I mean, she says
that's what she wanted
with that fantasy of being the castaway known about town. But perhaps she still wanted to have her story be involved with it, and to be completely exempted is the far swing of what she wanted. She didn't want to be the focus of it. She didn't want the island to be a chapter in the book. She wanted it to be the basis of the book, and perhaps her story be, you know, like just
tangential.
Yeah, and not even really called into question, because that's not the story she wanted to go into. However, the confrontation with her daughter, I'm using air quotes, and, you know, wondering about her own identity. And it's now I'm into murky territory, because I think that it's opening up big, big questions there.
Well, like, I mean, so, I think it's – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
No, it's all right. Go.
So her not ever making it into the story. When I got to the end of the book and they have that strange time, and it's not actually in the very last chapter, it's in chapter 4, they have that strange time where she goes and meets him in his room, and there are all these kind of knowing looks around everyone, and all of these people.
Friday's at the table. Where he's at the table? And yeah, Friday's sitting at the table?
Right, but this is before that. This is when they eat, and they'd only brought two dishes. And so after she ate, she made a plate for Friday. I thought she didn't exist. I thought that she was his muse, that the entire book was about Defoe's muse and how we come to storytelling and what language has to do with.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. Can I quote from the Times about this, where they said, the operative forces are not so much history or politics as art and imagination. How can one individual story be apprehended and translated through language by another? In what ways do we project our interpretations onto others, especially in cases like Friday's, where muteness guarantees the lack of rebuttal? What responsibilities, if any, does an author have towards his subject material and sources of his art? Sources of the art, that's in a New York Times discussion about this book, and their focus, like you're saying, about what actually Coetzee is saying here, discussing. This is what bugs me, is why is it doesn't bug me, but it's just question, like, why is it in this Robinson Crusoe format or discussion or under that umbrella?
Well, when I looked at it that way, I thought this was something that was so it's old enough so that it's very otherworldly from where we existed in the time that Coetzee wrote it, right. And or Coetzee, I don't know how to pronounce his name.
I've heard they actually Coetzeer, and that's double E and makes an R sound, but that could be some BS. I haven't confirmed it. Like, it was just a teacher once.
I also felt that Robinson Crusoe is a story that, even if none of us has ever read it, everyone knows the story of Robinson Crusoe, and it has been used as the basis for many other stories, and it is completely ingrained in our culture. So
the
I think that
the castle.
Yeah, so I think that makes it a little bit easier to use as a basis,
right,
for a story like this. So when I got to the place where I thought, oh, well, she never existed at all. She was, you know, for the time and for a woman of her standing, she fell into bed pretty easily with both Foe and with Crusoe. You know, she did it for, you know, it was a comfort thing for Crusoe when he had been so ill. And then it was just kind of a given when she slept with him. And mind you, Friday's behind the curtain. So, and certainly for the time, it seemed to me that, like, well, this, you know, this probably isn't a real person. This, it seems more like a muse. It seems more like this is, you know, he is visited upon by this woman.
Yeah, I really like that interpretation. I'd have to let it dawn on me, because I hadn't.
No, I think so too.
What did you think, Daniel? Not about the muse part, but just about the...
Well, it was a really interesting book. Trying to think about it and decide how to think about it, like you're saying, there's a lot of angles that you could go. I did a little bit of digging around, and one professor that I found talking about it, he spent so much time talking about just the cover of the book alone. And it made me sort of go back and really think about the role of the author and the decision to tamper with the works of another author. And, you know, I was looking up, so Foe is a very conspicuous title. And then to play on, I always knew this author as Daniel Defoe. So I was under the impression that Coetzee had changed it. But apparently this guy, he was actually originally born Daniel Foe, and he changed his name to Defoe to make himself sound more important.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then you have that juxtaposition, like right there on the cover of Coetzee and Foe, and it seems to sort of scream at this implication of the author, you know, and this sort of
that what's left out is like really focused on it. It's almost like a relief. It goes into the silences that are being talked about, I think, too, where there's this. In the absence of, and this is kind of Friday's ability, you sit and like let the words come, or there's that section where he's talking about the words, if you're going, like start to form themselves, like there's this other place that you get to. So, okay, so this is like language, and this makes me think of the dancing scene with Susan Barton whenever she was like really wet, because she was kind of scolding Friday for being into his flute and like not listening to her, and like him not being able to listen to her, like her concern about him not having language like to create a self with and all these kinds of things or to tell the story is a real big concern of hers. And like she got mad at him dancing once, but then later is really cold in a barn and starts dancing and feels this otherworldly euphoria, makes contact with something that after she's dancing she can't express or remember anymore, but feels the afterglow of being there and realizes that she's connected with Friday or understands Friday a little bit more because she thinks that she understands what he is getting at maybe sometimes in his life, or why he sings, why he dances. And and it has to do with something that is, I mean, if you think about the muse, you know, if this is really Susan Barton as being a muse, not just for Foe, but also for Coetzee, then this is really interesting because he's able to, as a being, as a writer, let's take the material person, J.M. Coetzee, you know, he gets to go and be a woman on a castaway island for a little while. You know, he runs into things and questions about that, but he's able to explore and to go places.
I want to follow up on that, which you were talking about in terms of Friday and the him not being able to speak. Because I really think that this is like at the core, at the soul of this book, is Friday having no tongue. And this is on page 133 of my version. And I think, Susan Barton is talking to Foe. She says, I think it's her. It might be Foe talking. Whether writing is able to form itself out of nothing, I am not competent to say, I replied. Perhaps it will do so for authors. It will not for me. It's Susan Barton talking. As to Friday, I ask nevertheless, how can he be taught to write if there are no words within him, in his heart, for writing to reflect, but on the contrary, only turmoil of feelings and urges? And I just think that really goes to the core of this book, which is that particularly when you make like one of the main characters mute and you're talking about muses, and how can she be his muse? How can she, in other words, what is it that is in us that we express or can express if there are no words? You know what I'm saying? Like words like being
of a self.
Pardon me?
I said the primacy of a self. There's something right. Like, there's like a basal line of being that you might not be able to even be in contact with because of words. And I think that kind of goes back to that silence thing, like letting the silences, I think she was scared of as well with him, and like found that she would like fill up the time saying things and he wouldn't really hear her, but he didn't really need to because she was just kind of saying things. It wasn't necessarily anything that he had to respond to or could respond to, or it was a kind
exactly.
of.
Exactly. I mean, we don't know if he could, you know, like what we don't know.
I tried thinking about it, and I've been working on this damn book for years. And after a while, I started thinking about it as Coetzee talking about the process of creating a book or telling a story and of writing. And you get to the island and there is silence and there's this kind of, you know, curmudgeonly old guy who plods through his day, and he is building these terraces, these whatever, thousands of rocks that he's building terraces, and there's no seed for it. And I think about everyone, every one of us has written, every one of us knows that despair of feeling like the field is fallow and that the seed isn't going to be there, and that kind of intense, I don't know, that arid place where, and that despair of thinking, I am never going to get this out. This is never going to come out of me. This thing that's inside of me that needs to come out, that needs to be written. And I don't care if it's a term paper or a novel or anything, it needs to come from inside of you. And that barrenness is so acute when you can't get, when you can't find the words, when you can't pull it out. And in the, I thought that it was very telling that at the end, in fact, Friday did learn to communicate. He did perk up. He found ways. You know, he just survived when they were on the island, and he did, but he did interesting things, throwing the flower petals. That was an interesting thing that he did, but he didn't talk about it. And in the end, he was writing, he had a pen in his hand, and Foe is just lying in bed and says, leave him alone, let him at it. He's just filled pages with O's, which, you know, the letter O, right, is zero. There's nothing there yet, but it will come. Maybe tomorrow you can teach him an A. And this is the way we move forward. Crusoe built walls. He built something that someone could see later. You're there in the, you know, you're on the island. It's quiet and desolate, and you're building walls. But that whole thing of how you actually get something together to how you actually create is a lonely, difficult, arduous process. So that was, you know, in the end, which is also why I made her the muse. She flits in and she brings something with her. She's very much alive. Even in her despair, she's very much alive.
I think, sorry, go ahead, Daniel.
No, I was just ruminating on that story audibly.
Yeah, I was going to say with Friday and his muteness, and with Susan Bartle, and it was Susan throughout the entire story struggling to get her voice heard, I think it like points to the obvious themes of like women not having their voices heard and minorities not having their voices heard. And I think, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but this was written in, what was it, 1986? In
86, 87, yeah.
Yeah, and Coetzee is South African, writing in apartheid South Africa, of course. So there's that.
Wasn't he criticized for that this book didn't address the political issues in South Africa at the time?
But of course, it's not explicitly political, but it does bring up those themes of certain groups not having their voices, and it also brings up the language aspect. I know during the island, Crusoe mentions, what was it, bring firewood, and then Susan responds, bring wood, and Crusoe says he only understands firewood, not wood. And this idea of language being this control, this power tool that is used to to control other people, that runs throughout the theme. I think Foe at one point says, isn't it nice that Friday doesn't speak, because you can make him, I forget, it's feel or do or want anything that you want him to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that it's very political in that way. In that we all know what is the actual outcome, what actually got written in the book. She's not in it. And Friday is a slave who does Crusoe's bidding.
It's true, but to push back on that a little bit. So one of the things I read was that he was criticized for this being insufficiently political for a time when some very intense things were going on. Like Cesare was saying, they're coming to sort of the climax of apartheid and the end, and Mandela being freed in 91, I think. Yeah, I'm not sure. But, apparently there were critics or South Africans who felt that this was in some way sort of an author intellectualizing forces that were very political on the ground, but that this was a book in its heavily symbolic and subtle kind of format that didn't address these issues in a way that was communicable to the broad base of people who were experiencing this sort of political landscape on the ground. And that I can, to some extent, understand. In a way, this book, it's for a highly literate readership. It's not really a book, even though I will say one thing I really love about Coetzee that I loved in Age of Iron, which Nathan also had us read, is that his prose is really lean and it's very, very deep while still being lean. I can't really think of another author who I can think of off the top of my head that marries those two things the way he does. But I don't know. Yeah, so that's all I'm suggesting, that there may be some validity to that claim, or at least it's worth investigating whether it's political enough in that sense and being democratically accessible to people who might have needed some political assistance.
I mean, sure, but at the same time, that brings us to the whole, you know, is the novel a political tract, which I don't know if someone has more deep opinions on that.
Like, what are the expectations?
Precisely.
For something to be at the same time encompassing and general, you know, enough to be like, you know, I don't think that it's not a newspaper. It's not for everyone. It's just doing the furthest that you can on something. You know, I think there's been a lot of criticism with like the scientific community and like their publishing, and certainly like, you know, philosophy gets a lot of this, right? Like, for not being understandable. And that's, I think that's one kind of thing. You know, I think there's people who are, people say that people who can't do teach. And I think that's absolutely wrong. I think that there's people who can teach and that's a skill. And then there's other people who can do a thing, but they cannot teach. And that's a failing in the other way. So being able to make something is one kind of thing, but then being able to take an argument out there or to turn minds around in your own lifetime. I mean, I think so much about like when we've read, you know, Kafka, to not be really understood in your own time is, I think, the game of writing. You write kind of for the ages and hope that something sticks if you're doing it well enough.
As you know, I don't ever read anything about the book while we're reading it, but I find it odd. So I just looked up, Mandela was released in February of 1990. This was written in 86 and 87. And I wonder how much... I mean, if you wrote a novel right now, would it have to be highly critical of neoliberalism? Would it have to, I mean, do you have to save people with every book that you write? I mean, just because you're an American, do you have to, how many apologies are you going to make for Trump today?
Didn't Coetzee have a history of?
He had a history of being against apartheid.
Right. So, but being vocal about that political position, obviously.
Does he have to do it in his art? I mean, does it?
No,
have
he doesn't to? Have to. But I think that he had a pretty strong history of that, and that's one thing that critics jumped on. I'm not saying he has to. I'm just saying.
I think it's an odd thing to criticize.
Well, one thing I would maybe, not that I'm standing behind this, but I'll just put it out there. This is to piggyback on something you guys were also talking about on the Baldwin call you just had, which I thought was great, by the way. So I was having a conversation about Andrew Jackson with a guy the other day. He was talking about, he was making a similar point to the one you were making about Baldwin in the call, Mary, that it's necessary to view people within the context of their time and to criticize them based on proper expectations about what they could have actually been aware of and really understood in the context in which they lived, and to not sort of, and it's sort of unfair to foist historical norms and standards on someone who obviously couldn't have been aware of those standards and therefore couldn't have lived up to them.
But Jesus, Jackson?
But yeah, okay. So
he was a fucking devil, man.
So I agree with that basic thing, but it seems also conceivable to me that as you're saying now, the criticism of these figures from our particular standpoint might also be a kind of self-deterring process. Like, that may not be fair, but at the same time, it's conceivable that vocalizing it now in this context may be a part of our setting ourselves apart from it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if we emphasize so strongly that, yeah, they should be taken in context and not criticized, it may be that vocalizing our own critical distance from that gets left too much to the side that we don't sufficiently engage in that process today. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I understand that, but I feel like this novel is super ahead of its time, and I'm obviously reading it in the context of today. But like what I get from the character of Friday and from the character of Susan is Coetzee in a way saying that he can't speak for these characters, you know, and he can't bring out Friday's voice. And I think the only agency that he gives to Friday is his six note flute playing, his dancing, and the one time he throws those petals into the water. And in the same sense, Susan, that like it's constantly the problem of not being able to speak for this person. And I think that in a sense relates back to this essential nature of Susan being a woman and Friday being an ex-slave, a black man.
Yeah, and the two characters that you're proposing, Cesare, that Coetzee saying he can't speak for, are the center of this novel. They are the center, the primary characters of this novel that he can't speak for.
But he does speak for.
But he does, and he doesn't. I mean, he does in sort of a sort of the opposite way by not doing it. Like he can't. So I guess he attempts, but
maybe doing the best he can in the form of language to point at that fact of speaking for someone else and make it conspicuous.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between trying to walk in someone's shoes and like assuming that you're in their skin and know and can speak for them. And in that way, I see him really trying out some of the things that, you know, and maybe this is just like a creative thing, but when, you know, they were talking about Susan Barton about being a writer and what it took to really just go there and like where language could take you and how things could like come of themselves. Like once you started going, it seemed like a process of discovery that is helpful and not in a way that's proscriptive or trying to tell you that this is the circumstances of these people, but open up the door to the unknown, which I think that he tries to do with Friday. And like, I see that there's a lot of respect for his character in this world, not necessarily that you see it from Susan Barton, but in their relationship together and in the way that the story kind of bears out their relationship. You know, Friday gets the last word in the end. And I was looking for this little bit, but it said it explicitly, something like the story won't be over until we can find a way by art to give Friday a voice. That's paraphrasing. But I think that, you know, the horror of it, that she can't look in the mouth of us, you know, that a slaver cut out his tongue and that she won't let him go back to a plantation. I mean, these are very real concerns of the time that surprised me as details, just because I don't know, you know, I don't know when Robinson Crusoe was written or when this was written. You know, I didn't take in that background stuff. I just took it for what it was. And to hear those horrors, it seems like they're really considered and thought out, the dangers of slavery. You know, it seems very political in that way, because it shows how ugly it can be in a true way without being very pointed. And
yeah, and here is the South African writer writing in South Africa and making the one Negro black man in this story mute.
Yeah, I thought in the sense that the novel contextualized it to the 18th century that it was supposed to be written in was important in the sense that like Susan was in a sense a terrible person by today's standards, right? I mean, when she was on the island, I think she continuously thought, you know, she mentioned how like ugly Friday was. She would wash the things that he touched. She wondered why he didn't find her attractive as a woman, continuously complained of him as dumb, but still held this essential human nature of him as not being able to sell him off to slavery or give him up to slavery.
And one of the things I found so striking about that relationship was, you know, I mean, they're literally stranded on a desert island together. You know, he's one of only one other person besides her on this island. And despite that sort of, you know, what you'd probably think of as a sort of claustrophobic proximity, there's still this just massive gulf between the two of them. There's this massive chasm of incommunication that to me seems to, it's not sufficiently explained by his lack of speech in any way. I mean, there are so many ways. I mean, we know very well that in face-to-face interaction, the actual spoken language is a rather fractional part of communication that goes on. I mean, body language and gesture and, you know, probably other sensual information, you know, is a huge part of it. And so it seems almost very conspicuous to me that no other form, at least until the end of the novel, of communication is really given much credence. You know, it almost seems like, you know, she's pretty much avoiding the possibility of him being able to communicate like Foe says in order, or, you know, like for Foe suggests, or maybe it's Crusoe that suggests, you know, wanting to retain the ability to put words in his mouth and to think of him in the way you want to think of him.
When she does feel like she wants to communicate with him, when she tries and she goes and tries to make music with him and then can't do the six notes that he does over and over again, and changes the tune and thinks that that will bring them to a better communication. I thought about how what she was doing was simply by rote, and it wasn't actually trying to understand what he was playing. She was trying to bring him, assimilate, you know, she wants him to assimilate into her understanding of what communication is. And there were all sorts of things that he did on the island that she didn't try and understand. She didn't try and understand what he did with the flower petals. She did, you know what I mean? I felt like it was.
Yeah, I think that was the one where she really did wonder at the flower petals, but mm-hmm. all along she was trying to make him, you know, like convert him, or she was doing it for herself and was outraged whenever he didn't notice her playing. And she realized that he wasn't really paying attention to her musings on the, no pun intended, but like on the flute to try and like get his attention. He was locked into some other place and she was just a passenger, like along with that. It wasn't a communication between them like she thought, because she saw it as like this one way thing, you know. But she also thought that, like, I thought it was funny whenever she was on the island with Crusoe and she was wanting shoes. And she went ahead and made shoes or whatever, and they didn't like quite fit right. And Crusoe, because he wasn't making, it was taking days, but he was on his own time. Like, that's what I'm trying to get to the point of with Friday too, as a character. Like, it's not just that he's mute. It's also that he was stranded on an island for 30 years with another guy and they had no enemies. I like that line. Like, they had been turned. And so we all think about Crusoe, the man on the island, but like there was another man going through another experience on that island too, who was equally bereft of society. And like, so where Crusoe was like more curt and literally died whenever you tried to like take him off the island, you know, he was sick in that, but you know,
and interestingly, Friday did not die when taken off of the island. He adapted to being with Crusoe. So that's an interesting point to look at too.
It just reminded me of that part, which again I forget, but it was when Susan asked about how do you teach or how do you discipline Friday, and Crusoe mentioned something about laws are for immoderate desires, which and there are no immoderate desires on the island, so therefore you know, punishment is not necessary.
Interesting.
They're definitely not on Fantasy Island.
That could be a line for that, yeah.
Okay, so if Barton is a muse, that makes me think that the daughter is a conjuring of Foe. That this is almost like a world where the Star Trek holodeck or whatever, where he made a copy of her memory and it's not right. And she's like, no, this isn't my daughter. You got the eyes wrong. You know what I mean? Like, you can say, and like, I guess I could pretend that this is my daughter if that's what we're doing. But
wait, are we concluding that Foe brought the daughter in?
Well, I have one line for this, and I thought it was, again, my thesis about how this is all about how, you know, men have a terrible way of speaking for women, and when they create these women, they're all the same. And if you recall that her daughter had the same name as her. And there's this line which sorry, on my Kobo e-reader says 0%, so that means nothing, but it says, you are fatherborn. You have no mother. The pain you feel is the pain of lack, not the pain of loss. What you hope to regain in my person, you have in truth never had.
That was, yeah, that, I thought that was just an incredible line, too. I love that, the idea of fatherborn, which means that, you know, a male author created
right.
you.
Right.
And it, and the little girl says, look how alike we are, and, you know, put her hands in hers, and her, they were nothing alike. And the other thing is that after this time, I think the daughter's too young. It's like she is straight from memory, from an, you know, from an old memory. And The Conjuring is especially notable when he brings them into the, you know, they go to his boarding house, wherever it is that he's living when he's not living at his house, he brings them in. But also there's, you know, there are parts of you, as you write a story, there are parts that come in and entertain you and then you take away, you write them out. I mean, I think that there are some aspects of this that are just very much about the process of creating fiction. And it, you, what are you going to consider for characters, and you know, how is the action, you know, the time that Susan understood Friday was when she went into a trance like Friday went into, and it was action. It was her taking action. And that is always something when you're writing that you, you know, action moves your story. And she couldn't, you know, she was blissed out by it, by actually acting of her own volition in the story. So,
and really writing, you know, she said, you know, how easy it is to write. I never knew until I started to do it, you know, and like starts to second guess foe. And you get the idea that she actually would be a better storyteller, perhaps, because her letters aren't bad. You know what I mean? Like, her letters are written interestingly.
And, although she does write to him in the beginning about how difficult, like, oh, my, you know, the paltry information that I gave you, now that I sit down, I see how paltry it was, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But at the same time trying to make, you know, the point that if you, it just seems boring, it's because you're missing, again, that silence. Like, you don't know what it was like to always hear the wind all day. Like, that's a hard thing to convey. And if it seems like I'm not telling you much, it's because that not much is so big.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a big difference between experiencing something and writing about it too, also.
But it keeps pointing to this importance of writing. And I always thought that, you know, those episodes of Friday dancing and Susan dancing at one point spoke to this, like, possibility of experiencing things that are, you know, apart from language. But at the end of the book, I mean, they're teaching Friday to write, right? It seems like he's saying it's an essential part of being, is this being able to write.
I kind of thought of that as him being elevated into a true character in the story. Because in the story, you know, in Robinson Crusoe. Well, in Robinson Crusoe, I mean, his eyes light up when she says something about him going, you know, when Foe talks about him, well, you know, okay, you don't want to send him back to Africa. Have you thought for a second about maybe bringing him to some place in London where there are people who are like him, where he actually could communicate? Is this all really just about you, or are you actually concerned about him beyond his just life and death? Are you just dragging him around with you because you want this shadow? I love that part about the shadow. Does your shadow speak? And but when it came time that he was actually writing, I thought, oh, this is the place where he's turned it over. The story's not going to be about Susan Barton. The story is going to be about Crusoe, and it's going to be about Friday. Friday is like writing himself into the story there. Mm. I could be very wrong. I have flights of fancy while I read.
It's interesting too that he sort of leaves it there. To have continued on and had Friday learn to write would have required Coetzee, you know, or Coetzee through Foe to really start putting more and more words in his mouth. I mean, before you have Barton kind of doing it and then Foe doing it to some extent. But then if it had gone on, Coetzee would have had to start doing it too. And then, you know, everyone would have been putting words in Friday's mouth. So he at least, Coetzee sort of begs off there and leaves it to the reader to suppose.
Maybe because he thinks Friday is saying a lot, even without a tongue.
Hmm. Or maybe it's the point where the actual writing of Robinson Crusoe begins.
Yeah, so I see like this kind of like a three-part thing here going on. I think that all of these things are right. So in the one hand, he gives this character who can say a lot without saying anything on the island. And then he gets language because people can change and like you can grow. And like he was just deprived of it. It's not like he, you know, there wasn't a need for it or the capacity to do it. And so, yeah, so now he goes and he does what he can, even if he doesn't have a tongue. And then you have this third thing, which is that if the Robinson Crusoe novel we know has a speaking Friday in it, and this story is an origin story, but Friday had not been speaking, then maybe it's that by the time Foe wrote the novel, he was in a relationship with Friday with language and was his own Robinson Crusoe to Friday as a talker and as a community, you know, writing that into his own experience into the novel. Perhaps.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Idea. That makes sense.
I mean, one of the things both I think as a writer and as a reader that you're required to do is sort of to fill in the gaps. And then I guess, you know, that's also part of just experiencing to begin with, you know, in interpretation. But we do it in different ways. You know, I mean, as a writer, you do it in words and you form things into an order of words, into a narrative. And as a reader, you sort of are on the other end of things and you're having to sort of cash out that symbolic code into experience and imagination. And to what extent imagination is entirely built of experience is an open question for me. But I mean, that's part of what was interesting about this book. And it's an interesting question to me too, you know, the extent to which human beings are made of stories, you know, at curators of stories or of generative sort of constellations of stories that are sort of evolving over time. And to me, that has a lot to do with questions about the self and things like that. And in, you know, a time now when the self is a much more problematic sort of idea for us, and we have people who are sort of taking different ethical stances on that. I think it's a very interesting question to what extent stories are related to the self and to what extent we can sort of get by without them.
That makes me right here. There's a something from what you're saying, Daniel, page 131. It says here, in every story, there is a silence, some sight concealed, some word unspoken, I believe, till we have spoken the unspoken, we have not come to the heart of the story, which is what I think is at the heart of this story. I ask, why was Friday drawn into such deadly peril, given that life on the island was without peril and then saved? But he does a long discussion toward the end of the book about and silence. And in fact, this is my favorite line, but you know, we'll get to that. But my favorite line is, because I have other ones, we must make Friday's silence speak as well as the silence surrounding Friday. This is just such.
Yeah, I can elaborate on that on 118. He says, many stories can be told of Friday's tongue, but the true story is buried within Friday, who is mute. The true story will not be heard till by art we have found a means of giving voice to Friday. That's what I was trying to quote earlier.
Right. And so what comes in terms of this as a novel, which is unconventional in terms of its structure and plot and characters, I even question still if the daughter was real, existed, was some kind of phantom. But it's kind of like, because the central character, in my opinion, the central character next to Susan is Friday and he's mute and can't speak. And how do you write a story? I mean, think about it. If you had a film of someone who was mute, that would convey more in the immediate moment, because even if they didn't know sign language, they could move in some way, like when Friday dances, to communicate something. But in a book, in words, it's harder. So I'm thinking, okay, what's coming out of this is really, because of the curious structure of this novel, difficult structure of this novel, is it's really poetry that we're seeing. And what this is, because even, you know, I'll be reading along, I was reading along, and it was started, I think Susan asked Foe, she said, I can't find the quote right now, but she asked, oh, here it is. "Before you declare yourself too freely, Susan, wait to see what fruit I bear. But since we are speaking of childbearing, has the time not come to tell me the truth about your own child, the daughter lost in Bahia? Did you truly give birth to her? Is she substantial? Or is she a story too? I will answer, but not before you told me. The girl you send, the girl you who calls herself by my name, is she substantial?" And I was like, why is he using that word substantial? What exactly is Coetzee trying to say here, trying to convey here by using this word substantial? And then I started thinking about the larger picture of the book, because putting aside the specific issue of the girl. And I was thinking, this is really a poem. This is poetry. This is not a novel, a traditional book. And then that brings me to this question, which I wanted to ask everybody, because it's fucking driving me crazy. What do you think about the last chapter?
Who wants to go first? Yeah, so, I thought I read a New York Times review of it, I think, from the time, and it mentioned something elusive, like it's the poetical voice, which I didn't understand at all. And the only way I can make sense of it is if it's Coetzee himself walking around his imagination, because he seems to set the scene in several different ways, and he walks around the kind of story, but he has the same character, stillborn. In a certain sense, I think Friday is the only one. It ends with Friday having, you know, speaking, but he's underwater and bubbles are coming out of his mouth. But I mean, he shows up a couple times, and so does Susan, and so does Defoe, but they're still solid, dry. And I feel it's like him kind of walking around the scenes of his mind and picking out what he's going to make of the stock characters that he has.
Yeah, but when I was looking at it and I was thinking, okay, if I look at this as a traditional novel, which it isn't, but let's just say, and I look at it from that point of view, I'm like, okay, they're all dead?
They're all dead.
That's what I got. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what's happening is that you're seeing this overlay of time. I'm trying to find it and I can't, but there's this moment where Friday goes into a trunk that has MJ on the initials. And I believe that's JM Coetzee's material. I think that he is there in the same space, just not in the same time. And this is that. You know, so before everything is in quotes, you know, it's all the letters and then it's all, and then to have this, as much as I can understand the disgust of that poetical voice, that makes a lot of sense. that it breaks out from that and becomes this other, and it is that exploration. Yeah. So, I mean, yes to what you're saying there about Foe in his own in mind with this. And I think that point right there can be taken to the whole novel. I think that.
Right.
What's that exploration of taking on somebody's shoes again, or, you know, each of these explorations, it's just more focused. But here I think that the reins are really let off, and that's the attempt to give Friday a voice at the end that he does by going deep into the unknown, the place without words. This is a place without words. And
in many ways, I mean, this is a shockingly, massively difficult, if not near impossible, thing to do, to write in language using words on written on the page, a character who's mute.
I came away from it thinking that what we were seeing were the husks. When you any big project that you've ever done, they basically have a life cycle, and when you get to the end of it, there is, you know, what is left are these husks of everything that was as you got through the project. And I thought, oh, this, you know, you're done reading the book, and you know what's left is just gonna, it could be blown away in the wind, because you're done with it. You're done with the process, and you're done with the project, and you have these husks there. And there is a death to it. You're done with a book. You're done with a whatever, a program.
I don't disagree, but is how satisfying is that for the reader? For the reader, again, and I guess this goes to what Daniel was saying about how this really is an effort for sort of a higher literary, you know, exploration, as opposed to just picking up a paperback at the supermarket.
Well, yeah, but I mean, are you not interested in? I mean, you don't read the whole book if you don't want to go through the process of figuring out what it's like to write a book.
This reminds me. I was thinking when I read the last paragraph, because I was editing some discussion we had, and now I can't remember. But Cesare was talking about, it's probably the state of the art episode, and I think Cesare was talking about how, you know, how it is when you're reading something and then you get to the end of it and you find that it was all a dream. It was all the main character's dream, right? Or something. I mean, there have been TV shows that have done that have like...
So lame.
It's so fucking lame.
But I didn't think that this was lame in that way.
But at first, that was my first thought, because I was still looking, I was still like living in that traditional novel structure way. And then at that point I was like, fuck, you're kidding me. But then when I stepped back and I was like, well, wait a minute, this is not what's happening. This is not what this book is about. This is not what, you know, then I could see the deeper, more profound layers of what was happening. But still, at first moment, I was like, fuck. But yeah. It's not as simple. Obviously that's not what it is, but I'm just saying it was fascinating. It was just, and it said to me, actually, it said, you know, it broke open the profound effort that Coetzee was making here.
One thing that sort of comes to mind is that maybe he's sort of making an effort to expose himself at that end point there by sort of coming out from behind the different narrators and speaking in a voice that can't belong to any of them. He's sort of exposing himself and his own voice in writing. In case he hadn't made that suspicious enough, he's just hammering it home there. You can sort of see as an ethical maneuver in a novel that has spent all of its pages basically raising the issue of voice and authority.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
This is, I mean, something that, without spoilers for his other novels, I think Age of Iron is an exception to that, really. Age of Iron was much more like a straightforward novel with beauty in it, you know, in its own poetic way. But we talked about it last time, but like Elizabeth Costello is linked with Slow Man. And the Diary of a Bad Year is unlike any other book that I've read, mainly because each page is broken into three parts by lines. And so you can read. Yeah. So, I mean, this is like I see as an exercise. I mean, and we get to see the fruits of it. You know, it's messy, but it's like the thing about novels that they're the question, you know, not the answer, right? So it's like that going on that walkabout with someone else's mind as it takes in all the things that it takes in and tries to, you know, explore is amazing.
Yeah, as an exploration of process, I found it absolutely, you know, really captivating in trying to, whenever I try and write, the walls that you hit and that emptiness, I really felt that when I was reading this. I really felt that, oh, you know, probably everybody gets that. You are not unique in your lameness.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Are there any, so didn't Foe present that girl to her?
Right, but Foe foisted the girl on her twice.
How does Foe know this girl?
Yeah, right. Maybe. Yeah, I mean, maybe like, how does he know anybody, right? Like, he has all stories of pensioners and debtors and hearing confessions of people.
So there's that's why I came to it thinking that it was all about the process.
Right.
Here is, you know, so I could write, if I write the daughter in and there's a reconciliation, you know, the happy reconciliation that he talks about, he sends her back and she rejects her. So that's not the story. Right?
It wasn't the truth, you know, so like Faye is flawed here as a writer within J.M. Coetzee's writer mind, because he meant the thing that was true for her. If you take Barton to be absolutely true in her own right, and that she knows her story. And then, you know, there's this invention to try and like fill the gaps.
If you sit back and just have a little daydream for yourself about your favorite novel, your favorite story, no matter what it is, lie back and try and put yourself in the mind of the writer and consider everything that they went through, everything that they left out, everything that they tried and that thing failed, and what you come up with at the end, all of that sifting for gold, and the gold that you read left a lot behind. There was a lot that went into it, and so that's, I mean, he's trying it out. He's, you know, that whole the story of her, the story being about her and her daughter, but she rejects her because she's not her daughter, because it's not really the story. The story is about Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah, well, I want to like add in, I think that the bundle with like the dead girl child that she's a part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry to bring up the words. I'm sorry. I don't like having to say dead girl baby, you know, like,
just,
but you know, it reminded me of, what was that story that we read where the guy has the nightmare about the sexy baby or whatever? You know, it reminds me of like, this is a manifestation of your
Dostoevsky.
What was that again, Dostoevsky? And
Crime and Punishment.
Wow, there's so much stuff in Crime in that one, like so many side parts. I tend to just think Dolnikov.
Not Svengali, I forget his name, but
Svengalov.
Yeah, Svengalov. Yes. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, that was horrifying, and I feel like that was very similar to, like, I guess it really was a substantial body, but was it, but I mean, it was also playing right on these fears of hers, you know, that that she's lost this, you know, child.
And the trauma was something I was sort of wondering about. I guess that moment that you mentioned, Nathan, where Faye tells the story as if it's sort of this story of her losing and being reunited with her daughter, and she has that moment where the air goes out of her. I thought, I guess, sort of naively, that was going to be her realization that this was indeed her daughter, and that she had disowned her or not known her or not recognized her own history and daughter and everything like that. And it was going to sort of compound this idea of uncertainty, that even our own histories are in some sense our own inventions or not in our control. But that was in the end way too conventional, because immediately he obliterates any certainty that you would, and she's just like, no, I don't like that story.
Or puts the uncertainty in Faye there. I mean, like, so that she is certain, but like, or to the world that Coetzee has created might be another way to like put it. Maybe that he had, I don't know, but yeah, there's, you know, it seems like, yeah, well, maybe she would just, you know, like go with whatever, and she's an observer to this world, but that wasn't the case. Like, she has a substantial history that she must have had all along in order to be a point in the story or to have a perspective at all. She had to be a woman so that she could, you know, like all these things form who she is. And yeah, it made me think too of that whole, the movie Changeling was based on that phenomena where somebody returned a kid to her and were like, yeah, it's yours. Yeah, it's yours. You're mistaken. You don't know better. And trust us. you know, and how frightening that would be to realize that there's a conspiracy to wrap things up at the cost of the truth. And what's, you know, she really has lost her daughter, and that's not resolved. But, you know, you want to make it a neat story, you know, and say that there's this reunion, but that's just not. And I think that kind of goes back to the novel Crusoe. It's, well, you'd like to think that Man Friday is, you know, kind of maybe like an equal on the island without others. But in real life, in Foe's real life, in Coat Z's real life story of this, they cut out your tongue. And that's awful, you know, and that's a part of the story that you're not getting right. It's not so easy to square or think about.
One of the questions embedded there too, I think, is, so what is the thing that actually makes a story out of just a collection of events? What is it that manifests the story rather than just this chaotic mishmash of details and perceptions?
Well, it was what Foe wanted to do.
Well, I'm just talking in general.
Yeah, and I'm saying in general, that's what Foe wanted to do. He wanted to create this story. He wanted to create drama. He wanted to bring in structures that she didn't want to bring into the story, because that was not the story. That was not what she felt was her story. But more often than not, whatever our story is not what's going to sell.
Like her story within that, with him telling the, yeah, okay.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I guess that there's a couple of different stories going on in this, because, you know, she has something to tell, and then there's the overarching one, which is this novel so containing all these things. I mean, there's a lot of collection of events in there, and I guess it's like an up and down quality thing.
Yeah, but I remember Foe, I don't know where the quote was, but he said at some point, he said, you know, I'm trying to bring in the drama to the story, because he didn't feel like the life on the island was very interesting.
That's right. Yeah, it's what does it make that makes it interesting to you and to others? And that's why something that can be a story to me is not really much of one to someone else.
Well, again, you have to think about, you know, you're writing the story for you. Are you writing a story for others? You're writing the story for your family. You're writing a story for the public.
And that's where it gets hard. Go ahead. Sorry.
I think it's prescient in our modern day of new media, where you can't just do things. You have to do things with the understanding that other people have to experience them as wonderful. You know.
Well, I don't know if the word is wonderful, or if rather if it's understanding.
Or significant, or, you know.
Yeah.
There's a line early on, if the company of brutes had been enough for me, I might have lived most happily on the island. But who, accustomed to the fullness of human speech, can be content with caws and chirps and screeches and the barking of seals and the moan of wind?
Right. Right. And I mean, like, one of the first rules of writing is you got to catch them in the first paragraph, got to catch them in the first line.
Yeah, the first 140 characters.
Yeah, exactly. You got to make it so that they'll turn the page.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's something that the story deals with, and this is like a larger issue for us now. And, well, I mean, I guess it was also in 1986 too, but, you know, like, who are we talking about when we talk about one or we? Like, it's gotten to be a massive amount of people with, you know, I have a hard time, Mary, we talked about that article I was trying to write. I couldn't get into who I was talking to because I kept taking in so many people to account, and I would have to start from the beginning of the universe to get anywhere. You know, I wanted to start out so general in order to be completely understood. And I, you know, it ended up driving me mad versus assuming that everybody has. And that's part of this bubbling thing, you know, where you assume that everybody, you know, has parents or hasn't been a slave or something, or, you know, doesn't know like the most abject situations, and you end up not being able to even imagine. So whenever Foe thinks that the island isn't interesting, it's because you really could not imagine it, or you can't, you know, you don't know what that experience would be, or you think that islands have coconuts on them. Like, that was a lot of, like, Susan Barton, you know, as a character had island fantasy stories and was saying that this is not like those. So,
well, I mean, in reality, whatever reality is here, but when you think about what we learned about the island at the beginning of the book, I mean, not much happened, right?
Yep, it was a very boring place.
It was very peaceful, quiet. You know, she met, you know, had sex with Crusoe, she hung out with Friday. You know, it wasn't a big deal.
She only had sex with Crusoe once.
Well, yeah, whatever.
It was more. It was like a. I mean, it was.
She had sex all over this book. I mean, even think about it. She sleeps with Crusoe. She sleeps with Foe. I mean, I'm sure she slept with Friday at some point.
Wait a minute.
I don't think so.
Laura's invoked the authority of reality here.
There's
but...
the story.
That's why I started thinking of her as a muse, because of the of her climbing into bed with Foe, and that she had, you know, for the time, slept with the Portuguese ship captain.
Right.
That's
I mean, they actually, I mean, I don't think she, they had like an affair. I mean, it was like more than just one night.
Thing, right. Right. Interestingly, if that the sailors would actually throw her overboard or put them off in a boat, mm-hmm. that seemed to me to be one of the most far-fetched things, that they would, you know, there was a woman, a sexually active woman, and they're going to
throw her away.
Yeah.
No, I had explicitly so. I think when she talks about Bahia, right, she says that what is the Portuguese girls leave the house twice in their lives for their baptism and their funerals.
Yeah,
right.
Everyone else is a whore, but luckily there are plenty of whores around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, there's that superstition. I don't know how widespread it actually was, but you always hear of the superstition of women on ships back in the sailing days.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was people were afraid it was bad luck, which was probably stemming from some sort of socially disruptive situation that got stigmatized and then became superstition.
Right. Fighting over who gets to rape her next, most likely.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. In so many words. Right.
Yeah.
The obvious solution is to throw her overboard.
Yeah.
All right, guys, aren't we happier?
Yeah, but I think even Foe says that. Doesn't he call her a dirty whore?
And then I don't remember those words.
I thought he was talking about himself in that passage, Laura.
Maybe he was talking about himself.
I think they were talking about writing and, you know, that.
We have to find that.
Using yourself, basically, in order to pay. Because, I mean, this gets into writing for audiences, because that's, I think, the comparison of boring there. Was
right, and that's the point, right? That's what Foe Woods, I mean, I guess if he was talking about himself, I can't remember. But that's what he was. That's what he is. That's, I got to make money. Obviously, he wasn't doing a good job of it because he's in debt. But, you know, that's what you
a
have
lot
to
of
do.
Great writers lived in great poverty and never had. But he wrote a lot. Defoe wrote a lot. But he did have debts. It was a very different world, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Different world, different.
Yeah, I don't know how you can expect to be appreciated in your own time with your art. I mean, that's a real. Yeah,
you know how you do it. You write the next vampire sex movie. That's how you do it. That's how you. I mean, I'm talking about today. Unfortunately,
I'm actually working on a fawning memoir of Trump, so I'm hoping.
You know, you'll sell at least one copy.
Yeah, two.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should come back around and. Anything else that we've got that we want to launch out with or have last lines?
Yeah, well, we could do some final passages or whatever.
All right. Don't we go in alphabetical order, dudes?
Sorry.
Me. I feel it's unfair, but yeah, I feel...
tyranny
of
the alphabet.
You're right, Daniel, that it does play on a lot of these postmodern tropes about authorship and voice and who says what. But I think it does a pretty good job of complicating it. But maybe I just say that due to the context of, you know, apartheid South Africa that I give to it, and a lot of like reading into it myself, that I, you know, the agency I give to these characters, you know, Friday, who has no voice, and Susan, who complains about not being able to write, even though she writes beautifully. But at the end of the day, I really liked it. My last line is on, it's really just the one sentence, but I'll give the context on page 13 to 14. And this is Susan speaking. Is it not possible to manufacture paper and ink and set down what traces remain of these memories so that they will outlive you? Or, failing paper and ink, to burn the story upon wood or engrave it upon rock? We may lack many things on this island, but certainly time is not one of them. I spoke fervently, I believe, but Crusoe was unmoved. Nothing is forgotten, said he. And then, nothing I have forgotten is worth remembering.
That's a good one. All right, if I can do two of them, if I can be so permitted. The first little bit I wanted to read was Chance had cast me on his island. Chance had thrown me in his arms. In a world of chance, is there a better and a worse? We yield to a stranger's embrace or give ourselves to the waves. For the blink of an eyelid, our vigilance relaxes. We are asleep, and when we awake, we have lost the direction of our lives. What are the blinks of an eyelid against which the only defense is an eternal and inhuman wakefulness? Might not they be the cracks and chinks through which another voice, other voices speak in our lives?
Yeah, that was
and
good.
With that sort of Cormac McCarthy article you guys mentioned earlier, which maybe we should link to since we've mentioned it a few times, that one really spoke to me because he seems to be mining similar territory. And since we talked about the Sunset Limited, perhaps for a future thing, there was a line in here that really sort of signaled to what I think is the heart of that work also, which I just wanted to read. There was too little desire in Crusoe and Friday, too little desire to escape, too little desire for a new life. Without desire, how is it possible to make a story?
Wow, yeah, and I can see what you mean by being the heart of it. That's yeah.
Yeah, hopefully we can explore that further.
Yeah, I don't want to get into it now, but that's good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but one more thing I just wanted to say, closing, to attack a little bit of what I said earlier, which is actually not my real position on this book. I do think it's sufficiently political and subtle. I think for critics, it's also very easy to jump on that angle, kind of like you were talking about, Nathan, where we can nitpick ethically a piece of art or a work for not being sufficiently attentive to a certain perspective or this or that, or not being overt enough, being too veiled. And then on the other side, not being subtle enough. You can come at it from any different way you want to. And then you sort of in the end, at least I start to ask, well, what is this actually doing for the reputation of the person asking this? Is it not sort of a self sort of aggrandizement, elevating their own voice in the discussion now at the expense of someone who's actually tried to make something? So I do think that this work deserves its place. Because, I mean, even today, for me, you know, someone who is not very connected in their life to apartheid, it can speak to me ethically about that situation. So it has a range beyond its sort of imminent situation.
The alternate ending was Friday calling them all racists and then going on the TED Talk circuit. So, you know,
that's good. Yay, Friday. Okay. Is that me?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I mentioned earlier that this is probably my favorite line. It's page 132, and I think it's Foe. We must make Friday silent speak, as well as the silence surrounding Friday. That's probably my favorite line. But there is a passage just below that that I like too, which says, how can he write if he cannot speak? Letters are the mirrors of words. Even when we seem to write in silence, our writing is the manifest of a speech spoken within ourselves to ourselves. And I think that's kind of a lot of what's going on in this book. Now, the other thing is that the last chapter really is an important thing to me. It's kind of freaked me out. I'm kind of living in a freaked out state right now. And kind of going through the day like jittery and anyway. And I think I think we could spend a whole 3 hours on just that chapter. And because like I mentioned before, part of it is very disturbing to me and freaking me out, and the other part realizes what he's really saying and what he's been saying throughout this book, and it is a poetic, I think, manifestation. But anyway, the first line in that chapter I really liked, which was "The staircase is dark and mean," and the reason why I really liked it is because when I turned the page and there it was, chapter 4, "The staircase is dark and mean," whoa. That is a line that character of line, quality of line that was not in the rest of the book. So, I mean, I really love that. And it's probably because of where it was placed, the drama of it. But at the same time, I just think that this last chapter just says so much about what Coetzee was saying or is saying in this book about writing, about language, about being mute, about men, about women, about muse, all kinds of things. I think it comes all out of this last chapter, which is, it's fascinating to me that it is, that it really does say that, all that, but at the same time just freaks the fuck out of me. So anyway, that's my comment done.
I guess it makes sense that it would freak you out that in so few words you could do all of that.
Yeah, do all of that. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I loved it. Thank you very much for suggesting it. I really enjoyed it. I think that the only Coetzee I read in the past was given me to was the book was and was Slow Man, and someone gave it to me who I let's just say wasn't a great circumstance, and I read it and didn't take it in and then left it on the train for someone else to have. And so now I'll go back and get my own damn copy and read it.
Make
again.
It yours.
Yeah. Context is all important. So the line that I chose was just something that I found really beautiful and interesting because it spoke to me. It really spoke to me about the way that I personally inspect the world in whatever circumstance I'm in. So she's writing to him. He's left the house and she's finally, you know, she's gone up into his attic where he writes and finally has the vantage point that he had when he was writing. And so she said, she's talking about the physical aspects of it and says, "There is a ripple in the window pane. Moving your head, you can make the ripple travel over the cows grazing in the pasture, over the plowed land beyond, over the line of poplars and up into the sky." And I really liked it because that's something that I've lived places that had imperfect glass in the windows before. And I really like that you can make the world, you can distort the world in different ways just by the angle that you're looking out of the window. And I also liked it in that it was, I thought, a really beautiful way of talking about being, you know, putting yourself in the writer's seat and how different that is from any other experience. And in these troubled times that we're having, you know, the smartest, you know, the people I respect the most say the same thing, that when things are going badly and you feel like there's nothing you can do, that the thing that you need to do is make art, is to create things, is to actually put yourself into the world in an artistic way. And if there's nothing else that you can do, don't think that there's nothing else that you can do. You can make art, and being creative is the most powerful thing that you can ever do. And so I liked that. That she, you know, she had a line about herself stepping into the writer's seat. And that is that.
Nice. I just want to say before, who's going up now, Nathan?
Yeah, but I don't really have a killer one, I don't feel. I mean, you guys have, we've talked about a lot.
I didn't want to die today anyway, honey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before you go, Nathan, I just wanted to point out that I think Coetzee is the most decorated writer, I want to say, of all time. I think he's won like every award. I think that's what I heard.
Yeah, it's either him or Stephen King. I can never remember.
No, it's not Stephen King. It's definitely not Stephen King.
Unless he won the Nobel Prize, right?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, Nobel Prize for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, name us, Nathan.
Yeah, I would also just I'll do this and I'll give whatever. This one's pretty good. It's on 85. "An aversion came over me that we feel for all the mutilated. Why is that so, do you think? Because they put us in mind of what we would rather forget. How easily, at the stroke of a sword or a knife, wholeness and beauty are forever undone."
Yeah.
I like that quite a bit. I mean, it just, that goes to the point of, I mean, I feel like maybe this is super political in the way that it really looks at Friday, just to go more in the direction. Again, it's kind of dawning on me that maybe in Foe, they take Friday's character 50 shades darker than in Robinson Crusoe.
That just reminds me, your line. Did you guys, was Friday also castrated? Do you remember the line where he was spinning naked in the cloak?
Where he was spinning, yeah.
Say it could be. But
oh, that's right.
I thought that he either had been castrated, or he had an enormous erection, because I couldn't, it really put her off her game.
I thought the only thing it said is like something that should be something that should be swinging wasn't her.
That's what I thought, like, not swinging. Maybe it's right there.
I mean,
really, let's go with the erection thing. That's better.
Yeah, I'll call erection.
Thank you.
We'll have to wait for the movie.
Dang.
Now, I wanted to bring that up because I thought that was incredibly important too. And you don't know. It's kind of like, well, whatever. I'm not going to spoil it. caught up in a web. But yeah, was he or was he not? I mean, it kind of matters a lot. It can inform a lot of his character if he was also castrated. If not, and she really saw through for the first time to his manhood, that's also important.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the only time it's hinted at, right? Because if you connect that with all the times she's talking about why wouldn't he sleep with her, why was he never interested, it's more illusion.
Yeah, looking at her, yeah.
Could have been that she was white. Never know.
White girl. The only white girl on the island.
Yeah, right.
It's like that Flight of the Conchords song where he's talking about the most beautiful girl in the room.
On the street. Oh, yeah. Depending on the street.
Remind me to tell you something when we hang up, when we go off air. I have to tell you, I'll tell you a very funny story.
No record.
Right. Well, I guess like still on the record, I would say I would highly recommend Diary of a Bad Year by J.M. Coetzee. I'm not confident enough to really say the Z-er, but I think that might be it. So pardon, you know. But I just really like it as a novel, and Elizabeth Costello I really like, it's not just like a philosophical digest, but it really puts in, it's got some great dialogue because it's hard hitting. It's just really hard hitting. And so Elizabeth Costello I think is really check out.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
All right.
Okay.
Anyone have any recommendations?
Great. What are y'all reading?
What y'all reading?
Milton Friedman.
Oh my God, man. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Man, that's a...
Feels so bad for you.
Elliot Abrams and the rest of the U.S. National Security Advisors, yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, I've been... reading all kinds of things, trying to, I have, God help me, I have a few ideas, so I'm trying to research some of those and reading a lot of social theory, and then I'm also reading The Marvelous Clouds by John Durham Peters, which is reacquainting me with a lot of media theory stuff that I haven't read in a few years, and I'm really enjoying that, getting back into. No other interesting fiction, I don't think.
How about you, Laura?
I'm actually reading Moore's Open Question, because this turns out a bunch of people are coming over here in about 2 weeks to talk philosophy. People I don't know, but a friend of a friend, and so these people are coming over and they want to read Moore's Open Question. So I've been reading that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have been reading a book of short stories, The Gin Falls in Love. The Gin Falls in Love and Other Stories. It's got a Neil Gaiman story in it. It's really it's very interesting. It's not, you know, huge, heavy reading or anything. And then I wanted to say a little pun here. I burned right through Solaris. And really loved that. And I am reading McLuhan. I'm reading kind of, you know, kind of going around the edges to get at the meat.
Do you think Solaris would make for a good talk, having read it?
Oh, yeah.